They will come to order. We would like to take their seats, please. We are now about 51 minutes behind schedule. Let me tell Mr. Benjamin at the beginning. This is the Customer Service Operations Safety Committee meeting from March 11th, 2010. We have an agenda previously distributed. I'll ask if there's unanimous consent to accept the agenda as presented. There are no changes. The committee is accepted as presented. We have the minutes of the February 18th meeting also having been previously distributed. Are there any questions or corrections? Not, I'll entertain a motion to accept the minutes as presented. Mr. Giancola moves. Is there a second?
Second.
Mr. Linton seconds. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. The minutes are accepted. We have one action item and two information items. Mr. Rapp.
Point of order. Just a question on the procedures. What is the procedure within the committees when, in terms of, how do I phrase this, the interchangeability?
Yes.
Of jurisdictional members. I noticed that Mr. Brown is a member of this committee, but is not yet alive. Do we have other members from D.C. take the seat in his absence, or what do we do here?
Mr. Graham, I believe under the rules that we've adopted for this year and the new committee structure, there is no provision for alternates in committee.
But I'm not an alternate.
I mean, from the standpoint of a committee, I don't believe we have an alternate for a committee member.
Right, but Mr. Brown is my alternate.
As a board member, that is true. On this committee, he is the member, and I don't believe we have a provision that allows someone to substitute for him as a member.
Can I have
Ms.
a...
Ms. O'Keefe? Well, explicit is kind of what we need. And we did discuss this, and that was a question I asked going into it, and in fact, we did not make such a provision. Perhaps we should have, but the board chose not to. Okay, and I will tell you that having specifically asked that question and pointed out that it made a difference for the functioning of a committee and the votes in the committee if you did it one way versus another, that I think that if we're going to do such a thing, I want to see that put in rules. And so if the board chooses to amend the rules, that's fine, but I think we have to have a full discussion.
Can I speak to that?
Mr. Graham.
Because this is an important point. And it just so happens that Mr. Brown is not present. It could be anyone. I don't want to focus in on his absence or participation or anything like that. But the fact of the matter is that Mr. Brown is here on this committee as a representative of the people of the District of Columbia. He is not here as an individual. And when he is not here, or when I'm not here, when it's the Finance Committee, the people of the District of Columbia really are entitled to their representation on the committee. And I think until we have a rule in place, it should be our interpretation that the jurisdictions be represented in the committee meetings. And we can clarify that, but there's a strong argument that that's really what is intended. That is really what's at stake here, is that the District of Columbia have a seat on this committee, designated for Mr. Brown, but in Mr. Brown's absence, if another member from the District of Columbia is here, they should take the seat.
That is a reasonable argument. Now I'll tell you what's wrong with it. What's wrong with it is the current committee structure is not established in a way that provides jurisdictional representation on the committee. And perhaps, again, that is something that should be done, but that's not the way it was conceived. Hence, you will see that there, in fact, is a member from the District of Columbia currently seated on this committee. There is not a member of Fairfax. In the previous committee, there were two members from Fairfax, none from my jurisdiction. Now, you know, that may or may not matter. And you can argue things a number of ways. The committee structure we're trying this year, that the board decided it wanted to do, different than we've done a long time, goes with small committees that are not based on jurisdictional representation, and I would say with the clear presumption that the committee function relative to the board is different than it has been. In the past, the committee has been essentially where the action is, and the board has been what in a legislative body is final reading. this system we're trying this year suggests that committee action is more streamlined and the full debate occurs at the board level. If that doesn't happen, then we do have exactly the problem that Mr. Graham is pointing to. So, you know, again, it wasn't my idea to go to this committee system, but I thought with others that, all right, let's give it a try. And I do think we should give it a try. But I think that means we actually have to use it the way it's intended to and then decide whether it works or not.
May I have a ruling on this of whatever nature she wishes to make?
I wasn't aware that Ms. O'Keefe was empowered to rule on anything, but I'm sure you can get an opinion from our attorney. It wasn't always the case either. That was an explicit rule change also since Mr. Graham and I got here, but early in our tenure. All right, so for the time being, we're going to proceed as though, you know, members move and vote. Other members of the board who are here can participate, and as chair, I will recognize them after board members, after committee members have had a chance to raise any questions or speak. And if that's not a good way or people aren't happy with it, then I suggest we take it up as a board matter, whether we should change the way we do things. With that, I'm going to proceed to the agenda. We have three items, one action, and a couple of not insignificant information items. First item up is the approval of the bus stop guidelines. Mr. Cato, you, I believe, have someone here to make that presentation?
Yes, we do.
And I'd ask you to move swiftly if you might.
Well, good morning. I'm Jim Hamry. I'm the director of the Office of Bus Planning, and I'm here to talk today about a very important but often overlooked element of the total customer experience at Metrobus, that of the bus stop. We'll change to the next slide. Our purpose this morning is to present to you for adoption our recommendations on how we as staff, working with the jurisdictional departments of transportation and other public agencies, will work to fulfill the expectations and the functional requirements of bus stops to support improving Metro bus services and Metro bus customer experience. Bus stops are the gateway to the bus system. It's the first experience you have with us. Not only do these recommendations hope to enhance passenger safety, vehicle safety, but also improve the function and accessibility of the stops, which is important both for making sure our buses are efficiently using their time as well as being able to encourage the use of fixed route transit rather than paratransit. We want to be able to identify efficient processes to sustain the program because the need to generate customer information to support bus stop coordination does require staff efforts. It enhances the customer experience rather than feeling like you're just standing alone in the wilderness. If there's a place, a tie to the community. And lastly, look at the placement of stops and how it impacts the performance, the cost, the efficiency of the service. Moving on to the next page, just as a summary, right at the moment, Metrobus has 11,795 stops. There's approximately an additional 5,000 to 6,000 of the jurisdictional carriers around the region. But what we're talking about today is specifically a uniform bus stop information design guideline for Metro bus stops. We're trying to accommodate the local users of those shared stops as well. And to accomplish that, the draft guidelines have been reviewed by key stakeholders throughout the region, not only citizen advisory groups, but also working very closely with staff, bus stop coordinators, departments of transportation, and other stakeholders. On the next slide, one of the fundamental issues is identifying whose stop and it is and who is responsible for what. This chart is intended to show the diversity of responsibilities for different components of getting to and from a bus stop. And as you can see, there's a lot of interaction with local DOTs, because Metro is responsible for the bus and the pole and the sign, but not necessarily the sidewalk and the right-of-way and the location of traffic signals and accessible pathways. And so these guidelines help inform others that are doing work on our behalf how we want to integrate into this total streetscape environment. And it's important to note that we share our stops with 12 different bus systems throughout the region. On the next slide, what we're specifically talking about are bus stop design elements. This is a schematic layout of the ideal bus stop. It provides for the flag and the pole to locate the stop and advertise that bus service is here. It provides the required landing pad for passenger entry and exit, not only for the front door, but also for the rear door, which is often lost at some of our heritage bus stops around the region. There is no provision for people getting in and out through the back door.
Heritage bus stops.
Sounds
so much better than old ones.
Well, and that's to keep it separate from the legacy systems that Carol was talking about in Alaska. This provides accessible pathway connections to corners to the destination, provides for information cases, maps, and signage where appropriate, trying to provide a prototype both for our basic stop as well as for the enhanced stop, the limited stop, the priority corridor, and also the transit centers. Identifying where seating and shelter need to be and under what conditions we would require them. An important consideration is lighting. We want to make sure that people feel safe at the stops, and where the service runs at night, we need to be thinking about that. Passenger waiting area, it's not comfortable standing 24 inches away from passing semis. We want to make sure that there is an appropriate enclave for people to wait, as well as deal with the issue of trash and vendor boxes. And so moving to the next slide, these challenges, we not only looked at the facility, but also what information needs to be provided there. So that we're really providing for a comprehensive bus stop. For customer information, the challenge has been readability. There's a lot of users and a lot of routes at some stops. Schedule tables don't necessarily easily fit. One thing we've been doing as a practice is that we'll put the whole schedule on the 6x30-inch case. And obviously, if you have a large line with lots of trips, it doesn't fit, and the only solution is to make the fonts really small. A consistent complaint we've gotten in all of our corridor studies is that the information is not readable, that it's not useful to the customer, and it certainly isn't meeting our intended accessible reading standards. And so we're dealing with that. But that means that we need to change the way that we present the information, the way that we process it. We have a lot of legacy systems in how we produce the information. It's been part of the advertising contract, the CBS Outdoor contract. And so now, as that contract ends, we need to figure out how we're going to produce this information in-house. Our recommendations: adopt some readability standards, provide for integrated stop signage so that we don't have the hodgepodge of different operators, but actually present a uniform and consistent approach and image, and improve the efficiency of producing that information. And so on the next page is where we get down to the details of recommending the sign. And we have had back in the corner here for a few months an example of what this looks like in three-dimensional real life. Now, I would point out that to preserve the use of the pole, we didn't cut it, but in its real configuration, it'd be about 2 feet shorter than that. And the intent is that we would provide for the Metrobus flag that has sufficient space and identity for whatever services are being provided there, but then also be able to accommodate the needs of the local operators in a uniform package. Also, as part of this is the recommendation for a new customer information display. Currently, we've been using a four-sided box, and it takes six sets of hands to hold it together while you pull information out, and it's sort of challenging to use. This case that we have on the pole there is very easy. It has a single screw at the top. You pull it out. You can change out your information, put it together. It makes the work easier and much more efficient.
You're talking about servicing it to change information on 12,000 bus stops.
For example, in December, I think we had to go touch 2,500 different stops because of the service adjustments that happened. And so this is a recurring labor. And so the more efficient we can make it, the better. We have also, as a result of dialogue with the Accessibility Advisory Committee, included raised letters as a tactile sign, excuse me, also in Braille, that indicate the bus stop ID number, so that you don't have to visually be able to read the next bus number up on the top there, but that you'd also, as a visibility impaired individual, be able to gain that information through the tactile touch. And so it provides a full accessibility to the information that's available there. We've increased the size of the fonts of the route numbers, as well as incorporated the website, the phone number, the next bus information, and tried to provide a comprehensive source of information at the site, and then supplement it with additional information in the information case. Moving on to the next chart, the way we would propose is that there is sort of a base level of information and facility, a enhanced level, and then when you get to a transit center, it's really more about volume and capacity of information and throughput of customers. But every bus stop would have a basic bus stop sign, a landing pad, and a sidewalk to make it accessible or an accessible path. For those stops where there's service in evening hours, we include lighting, and we would, for stops with greater than 50 riders a day, make sure that there is room for using the rear door and expanded boarding and lighting area. As I talked about the tactile plaque for the bus stop ID, we would be looking for shelters at stops that have greater than 50 riders a day. That was a recommendation of the regional bus study and of the concurred with at the regional bus conference. We would have system maps where there are shelters. That's a program that we started in 2004, and we now have, I think it's close to 1,000 system maps throughout the Metro bus system. Electricity would be optional depending on the need for lighting and for next bus. We would be recommending that at a minimum we would have the dynamic LED sign at all stops that have 300 or more riders a day. That's about 300 stops throughout the region. That's not to say that if someone was feeling like contributing through a development commitment or as a different policy, they wanted to sustain it, but at locations that have fewer than that number of riders, but that would be our regional recommendation. And lastly, an interactive phone system so people could get information directly from our customer service center at transit centers would be included. And then you can see the various staging to go to enhanced stop. You basically provide for all of those features, and at the transit center, you're providing for everything as well as the aspect of direct customer information access. As part of this study, we wanted to look at the impact on performance. There's about 67 lines in the system that have more than five stops per mile. It ranges from a high on the 80 line, we have 11 stops per mile, to a low of 2/10 of a stop per mile on the 5A. And that's because it travels 20 miles and only has four stops.
What's the average system wide?
The average system wide is between 6 and 7, depending on exactly how many miles you attribute and how you count it.
Sure.
But it's around the 6.5, 6.7 number. 4 to 5 stops per mile is sort of an industry planning rule of thumb, that quarter mile spacing is not too onerous of a distance to walk to access a bus stop. We recognize that there are reasons to have more frequent than that. By contrast, the state of Maryland, when they adopted their service guidelines in 2000, actually allow for up to 10 stops per mile in an urban area, which means basically stopping at every block through the downtown area. And maybe that's appropriate in Baltimore, but what we find is that with the closer spaced blocks, et cetera, that you really could space it out a little bit more, gain efficiency in running time, efficiency in boarding, and really move your bus along more quickly.
In simplest terms, it means if there's more stops, I don't have to walk as far to the bus, but I spend more time on the bus.
Yes.
It just takes longer to get there.
Yeah, we have some routes that achieve a whopping 5.6 miles an hour on a scheduled basis, but they do have a bus stop every two blocks, all up and down the line. And so what we're proposing to do and have actually begun evaluating is those candidate lines that have the highest likelihood of success in looking at how we can cull out stops and find the appropriate balance between accessibility and throughput. We certainly would not be trying to take away a stop from someone that's a candidate or a user of Metro Access. It doesn't take many trips to make it worth making that extra stop. We are certainly balancing out the association with origins and destination and the spacing and the geography, but we do want to cull through the system and look at this as one more way of finding efficiency and productivity improvements. On the next slide, this is a summary table of everything that we were talking about that's summarized in the report itself. The general length of stops that are required for the far side, the near side, and the mid block configuration, spacing on different types of services, the use of travel lanes, parking lanes, shoulders, et cetera, when it would be appropriate to use a curb bulb. All of these are included in this recommendation. And on the last slide then, the recommendation is to adopt what's included in the report. It's a report as well as the summary tables and the resolution that's attached. These are guidelines, so we certainly recognize that there are specific reasons to make accommodations and special conditions, but in general, we'd like to take these and distribute them to our associates around the region and then using this as a go-forward process as we rebuild stops, as we relocate them, as development comes in and gives us an opportunity for improving stops, as the Tiger Grant and the subsequent livability circulator grants. These are all opportunities for us to then fund these kind of improvements. Our next steps, as I mentioned, our evaluation, we continue to work with JCC and the locals to implement these. We assist the jurisdictions in prioritizing bus stop improvements, and we work to sustain this program. All staff that work on bus stop issues have now been consolidated in bus planning, so we have an opportunity for interaction between the customer information, the shelter map, the bus stop placement, the sign installation crew, and it's giving us an opportunity to really create a dynamic program to meet the needs of the region in the future. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Mr. Giancola.
Yes, I wanted to commend the staff for finally getting to the point where we're actually looking at this and certainly establishing more consistent guidelines on the signage and increased size. However, DC.staff has advised me that there still are a couple concerns in the District of Columbia addressing the one-size-fits-all type sign plan, and also the fact that in urban areas with shelters that we need to have some flexibility on where we mount the sign rather than having a separate pole. Mm-hmm. So when the appropriate time comes, I'd like to propose two additional whereases to the motion.
Okay. That's fine. Let me ask, though, I'd like a clarification on the point you raised. I thought that the question about placement, at least the one of the issues you raised anyway, placement on shelter, I thought that had been addressed.
The staff, DDOT staff and the Metro staff have been working on finding a way to accommodate that, and we certainly don't object to the request that the district has made at their specific locations where it is appropriate to find a way to move the flag up onto the shelter and to use the display cases that are built into the shelter as a display for this information rather than on the pole as indicated.
The question is whether the guidelines, as they're drafted, once approved, would provide for that kind of flexibility.
My interpretation and the review of staff is that it doesn't preclude us from being able to do that. But that would be one of the accommodations that we would have to make and why there are guidelines.
Well, then I can understand why Mr. Giancola wants language in the resolution. Mr. Benjamin.
Also, I think you've done an excellent job, and I particularly appreciate the fact that it's as thoughtful and as thorough and as careful and was coordinated with just about everybody in sight, which is really, really good. Where I didn't quite hear a solid set of words was if we say, okay, this is our set of standards, and I note on the resolution it says, we adopt the standards and we encourage others to, we recommend that others do. So we're not pushing them. If we adopt these standards, are we saying that we will in fact invest in sidewalks and pads and shelters? Is that something that we as a board are committing to in doing this? I know there's no financial impact on this. It just says, well, it could actually occur. What are we committing to?
Committing to a design approach and sort of some performance criteria. The specifics of how we've been integrating the bus stop need into the accessibility of building sidewalks. The Tiger Grant, for example, is intended to fund those connecting sidewalks and improvements. And so we're making sure that that's part of what's being considered when that project is implemented.
I hear you, but we got, 12,000 bus stops that we're going to deal with? Mm-hmm. Are we immediately saying, yes, we're going to invest in all of those bus stops to bring them up to these standards? I can understand the poles pretty quickly, but there are an awful lot of other things, and when you get the sidewalks that may go some distance,
yes.
And I know there are some bus stops that are in locations that are very hard to get to. Are we committing to taking all of those bus stops and putting pads and shelters where appropriate according to this? And if so, over what period of time? And if not, what is it that we're committing to?
Well, our financial capability to go do those improvements depend on, you know, the funding of the bus stop enhancement program in which is currently called Bus Customer Facilities in Metro Matters 1, and there's a line item in Metro Matters 2. We've been trying to use our funding to leverage improvements. We had a project, we worked closely with Fairfax County in designing improvements to, I think it was 20 stops, and coordinated with their sidewalk improvement program to provide that linkage. So our area of responsibility is the bus stop, and our commitment is to, is programmed to deal with the bus stop signs and poles and replacing those immediately, and then working as opportunities avail themselves to improving the bus stops.
Including the access to.
Including the access to.
Can we make that clear in this resolution that the funding is, we are not today committing to tomorrow digging up funding and being able to in fact implement every aspect of these, but that in fact what we're planning to do is over time working with the jurisdiction as funding becomes available, as they're capable of doing things, to upgrade everything in that direction, with the exception of, say, bus stops.
Mr. Benjamin, I don't think that's really a question for the staff person. I think that's a matter for us.
Okay, well, I mean, that, I'm just...
And I think saying it is saying it. I mean, you know, I guess on every action we take that isn't a budgetary action, we could say, it's not a budgetary action. We're not pledging to spend any money here. But that, I mean, I think it's a fair question to ask, but I also think the answer is obvious. This is not a budget action.
Okay, well, then
this is not an obligation to spend money on anything.
I understand, but I know that as soon as we adopt one of these, the next thing that happens is people come in and say, you adopted it, your standards are there, you have to go ahead and do something about it, otherwise you're violating your own standards.
No, it's a guideline. It's what it says on it is guidelines.
I hear you.
And, you know, to the extent that somebody says their standards, I agree with you, and, you know, they do push what we're going to do, because when you actually go and change something out, which is the real key here, right, when you're doing something, you're going to do it according to this. And if it doesn't mean that, then it doesn't mean anything.
And I buy that. And if what our if our position is, as we change out shelters, as we change out pads that we own, that we would do that, and that we change out bus stop signs immediately. What I'm concerned about is we suddenly get into a major shelter building, sidewalk building, pad building, which in fact impacts an awful lot of other projects in the capital budget. So I'd like to be clear that we understand what we mean by doing this, and if we are in fact talking about an enormous investment over a relatively short period of time, I don't see anything here that tells us what that investment is.
And if we were talking about that, that would have been in the earlier committee and not in this committee, because this isn't the budget committee.
Well, but I'm saying that I'd like to understand that before I adopt a set of guidelines. What are we actually saying?
Mr. Litton?
Maybe I should not try to clarify this, but that always gets me into trouble. But it's my understanding that this will be a standard of how we would go forth with bus stop replacements. When there is opportunity, such as in the Tiger Grant, where the grant itself pays for an actual replacement, that these will be the standards that are used. If we go forth and there's money available and we're doing additional building plans at some point in time and we have money in the budget that will allow us to accommodate, or the staff or the board makes a decision that they want to pay for bus stop improvements, these will be the standards that will be used. But this is not a bus stop replacement building program. It's just the standards that will be used when we build new or replacement bus stops. So that's the understanding that I have. Just like when we adopt, which we did before, and I wasn't on the other committee, when we talk about clean fuel buses, it doesn't mean that we are purchasing 30,000 clean fuel buses, but it does mean that the board has established a policy on the kind of technology that they will use when they purchase buses. Then the staff comes to us with a request for buses. At that point, it becomes a budget request, and the dollars then associated will be decided on by the board. So that's the understanding that I have with what's being presented before us. One of the things I, you know, so I just want to make sure I clarify my understanding of that. One of the things that I'm interested in, because I've already heard the discussion from Mr. Giotto about the district's desire for flexibility. And it's very difficult in this jurisdiction to come up with uniformity, but it would help our customers quite a bit if they got a sense of uniformity across the jurisdictions so they're not as confused. Sometimes some of us think that our people in our jurisdictions only ride in our jurisdictions, but they don't. This is a region. We try to build it as a region, and people benefit from some commonality across the regional boundaries. And I thought that our Tiger Grant application was once again an effort in our desire to come up with a regional system. And these bus landmarks, to some degree, build on that. Uniformity, commonality information, maybe even some economies of scale in terms of purchases, of some lighting programs where you could have some uniformity in terms of inventory and get better deals in terms of pricing. So there's a lot of things that could be done if there are a level of uniformity that we can agree on. Can we have a baseline, and is this what we're trying to do, of where we would have some common elements yet accommodate some flexibility based upon type of location? Is that what we're trying to get to? And how are we, how have we gotten to with our jurisdictions in getting to that as a baseline agreement?
That was one of the primary purposes of having a process, was to get everybody to a common point of understanding and approach. And that's why this is this is presented for your approval, so that we, Metro staff, have, you know, the concurrence that yes, we can go out to the region and represent, this is the way that we've been told to do it. And so we can then lobby.
Wait a minute. So wait a minute. This sounds like that's not what I thought this was. I thought this was is a byproduct of some agreements across jurisdictions, and some commonality of agreement is represented here, and we are in fact adopting that. And by adopting it, we are adopting something that people have bought into. What you just suggested seemed to suggest that we are proposing standards and we're going to lobby others to buy into.
No, I apologize. I meant to concur exactly with how you characterized it. This is the result of a regional cooperative effort. We're all in agreement on this, all the bus stop folks. I'm still mentally answering Mr. Benjamin's question on the funding aspect, because the Montgomery program is one that we're trying to emulate, where they created the bus stop guidelines at staff level, turned it into policy. The county council funded $10 million worth of bus stop enhancements. They've been very successful going through the county. I think they've improved over 500 stops to date, something like that, and really have accomplished a lot. Now, I don't believe in the original adoption there was a commitment that every bus stop in Montgomery needed to be just like the one at Veers Mill and Randolph, but the intent was that over time, as part of the capital programs, in coordination with the pedestrian enhancements and the accessibility improvements and all the other programs that are being, that are in the public environment of the street, that would be what gets implemented and what staff represents as
one,
a need.
One further question. You showed a slide earlier that depicted the various elements of government that are involved in funding and responsibilities for bus stops, which includes, you know, state highway administrations, you know, the city departments of public works. It goes down and down and down. Have all of those elements been engaged in signing off and agreeing to, or is it just the bus jurisdictions from the various agencies?
We have had active participation from all of the transit properties, all of the transit operators and their local governments. The Virginia DOT, Maryland DOT, because of the unique relationship, has not been a specific sign-off on this approach. In our discussions with them, and Tom Webster is behind you and can respond appropriately, I think this is consistent with what the state of Maryland had already adopted under their own program 10 years ago. And Virginia is a continuing, evolving condition, as Mr. Zimmerman can smile with his efforts on Columbia Pike improvements. And so I think we're really setting
the standard. Sounds like a lot of movement there.
DDOT has been an active participant, and we're very trying to be very responsive to their unique urban high-volume needs.
So it's still a work in progress.
Well, it will always be a work in progress because there's 12,000 stops out there, and every one of them is subject to a unique neighborhood and a unique condition. And every time we do one of our corridor studies, we come back with recommendations for improvements at 30 or 40 stops as part of the limited stop program, and and try and move the threshold forward on the rest of the bus stops. We recognize that on the grand scale of things, there isn't enough money to make a commitment to go fix every bus stop in the next 5 years. But as we go forward 20 years from now, we'll look back and say, wow, we've really accomplished a lot. And we'll have changed the accessibility and hopefully the perception and the experience of using bus transit in the region.
Sure. I mean, I don't think we will, you know, we will wipe out everything that has been misdone in 2 years. But I think if you can get all your partners to agree to be consistent in how they build and apply their resources, then you've accomplished quite a bit. And I commend you for continuing to push this needle forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I too would like to commend you, Mr. Hamry. I know this had to be a tremendous undertaking to try to deal with all the various jurisdictions. And I like so many of the recommendations, including allowing for rear doors, and particularly the accessibility improvements to make it more in compliance with the ADA. And for me, the larger font. Not to mention several other things. I think the guidelines provide, the information case provides very, very valuable information, and allowing room for the jurisdiction, the local jurisdiction, to add their signs. I think it's a yeoman's effort. I also think that it may be difficult to achieve absolute uniformity, but these are in fact guidelines, and that's your effort. It may not be one size fits all, but it's probably one size fits most, with allowing for certain flexibility, as you said, in certain unique neighborhoods or where it's so warranted. And I think that's inherent in the nature of guidelines. They are in fact what you aim to do where practicable. And I commend you on this, and I would like to hear the amendments as proposed by Mr. Giancola, but which I think will allow for that flexibility for those instances where these guidelines may not work for those stations. But I have to recognize that it's been a tremendous effort, and you are to be commended for that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, great for all the comments that have been expressed. Just want to make sure again we understand that right now the guidelines, but to do it pretty much on a piecemeal basis, but as opposed to a total regional basis all at one time? Piecemeal as needed basis.
Right. Our proposal is that we would go replace all of the bus stop signs and poles on a regional basis. We have funding in the bus customer facilities as part of Metro Matters 1 that was originally intended to do this, and we can accomplish that. But the improvements to the actual physical ground plane of the bus stop will be conditioned upon future grants and future coordination opportunities with jurisdictions and other projects that come along.
And what do you anticipate the cost to be if we were to do this on a regional basis?
Oh, let's see, $120 million?
Sorry?
$120 million?
That's a little different.
To do all 12,000 stops?
Same standards.
Which seems like a big block, but when you cut it up into a streetscape project here, a new housing development there, it gets amortized away. And Alexandria has had a number of good successes with their TMP ordinance, where the developments have provided improvements. Now we can clearly say, please go build this at the entrance to your development. This is what we're looking for.
All right, thank you.
Other questions? Did someone have a motion? We have a resolution that's been submitted that would affect the action on these guidelines. And the question is, does the committee want to move it forward to the board with a recommendation to approve? Mr. Lynn.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
I have a motion to have a second. I recognize there may be amendments.
I second.
Okay, so it's been moved and seconded. It's now before the board. So the question is, are there amendments? Mr. Gentile.
Yes, I'd like to propose that we add in the whereas, again, adding the flexibility element here to the program to address the one-size-fits-all and the need for a separate poll. And as I read this, you could actually indicate that while it's a District of Columbia annotation, it could be a general jurisdictional notation. So here's the proposed whereas that I want to put forward. The District of Columbia Department of Transportation, could be jurisdictional departments of transportation, has provided special accommodations for the display of bus stop flags and schedule information as part of the design of DC shelters, or you could say jurisdictional shelters, that will make it unnecessary to install a separate pole at some locations in the jurisdiction or the district, in my case, while fulfilling the design criteria and information standards applicable to such stops. So that's one of the proposed whereas. Again, it's the whereas, you know, it's giving the flexibility in the whereas side, not necessarily the resolve side. And we also would like some consideration of a second consideration of a whereas. Whereas the District of Columbia has requested a smaller Metrobus flag at non-shelter stops as an option for use in neighborhoods. Because there are some neighborhoods, you know, you don't want to necessarily overwhelm them with this huge sign. And so it's a little more compatible to the design of street signage in those places. Again, the standard, the font, the concept is supported. It's just there's some flexibility built into the process.
So it seems to me there's three things that you've just noted. One, that you essentially are concurring with Mr. Hamry's statement that the flexibility is inherently here, so it need only be acknowledged in the resolution, which is why you're proposing it in the findings, essentially, in the whereas. Secondly, and thirdly, you have two specific accommodations you're looking for. One has to do with the pole placement of a pole in specific kind of context where that's not necessary because of the nature of the shelter. And the second has to do with the option for it's the top sign up there that you want an option for a smaller version? Okay, so it seems to me we have those two things to consider. And I would say that if we're going to introduce such flexibility, you know, or suggest it in this manner, I would prefer that it was not jurisdiction specific. It should be on the basis of the nature of the stop, which might occur in any jurisdiction. That's my thinking. Other members?
I would agree with that.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to exactly suggest the same thing. I would prefer that if there's a need for such flexibility, that we provide it uniformly so that the flexibility is used in applications of the standards across the jurisdiction. The only other question I had was, has this been raised before, these particular points?
The size?
During the discussions that you've had with
these two points?
Yes. And the size of the sign, we were trying to make sure that it stood out and that it was visible from a longer distance. It's sort of tied to the spacing discussion. I need to be able to stand on the sidewalk, look up the street, and see my sign. And so the consensus recommendation was the size that you have. That's not to say that when you see a golden M, you know what it means no matter what size it is. And so for specific applications, we can scale that. And so long as we don't make it too small, we can still achieve the performance. And I know exactly the neighborhoods that Mr. Giancola is talking about. We would need that flexibility to get something installed at Georgetown or places with other historic sensitivities and that flexibility would be helpful for us. As far as accommodating on the shelter, that's actually something that's applicable with the Montgomery program, with the new Fairfax program, with the Prince George's program that's coming online. It's an evolving situation. What we really wanted to do was establish a performance criteria and to the best extent possible, if it can be consistent. So I always know, particularly for an accessibility situation, I always know that the shelter's here. I know where in that shelter certain bits of information are going to be. Or if I'm coming to a stop, I know approximately which pole to look for if I'm visibly challenged finding it based on the tactile definition. And so we wanted to have some consistency between approaches.
Yeah, I agree with you.
The question
Mr. Downey.
With respect to the size of the sign, the ones shown here has a very large number of routes associated with it.
Yes.
In a neighborhood where there may be only one route, would it be that size with a lot of blank space, or would it be tailored to how much information it has to provide?
Well, there's actually
the size of the letter, so that people can see it.
Right, and in a situation where it's a single route, yes, it would look a little lonely on the red background, but there's enough additional information that it would still look efficiently used and provide us that scale, that consistent size. But the flexibility of using a slightly smaller sign does allow us to address that issue.
I think that's a good point. Mr. Graham.
Yeah, I think that for us, the important point is that we have all these brand new bus shelters that have already incorporated the prospect of there being signs as part of the shelters. And so we don't need another piece of sidewalk furniture, if you will, or signage. I just say I really appreciate what Mr. Giancola has moved here, but I wonder whether we really don't need this, and we can do this between now and the board. We don't need this. We need this not only in the whereases, but we need it in the resolve clauses. Because, I think that's where we want the maximum clarity, that where we have a bus shelter, particularly, which has been engineered and designed to accommodate these signs, we really want the signs to fit into that design.
I actually have a proposal along those lines.
Okay.
I think I'm persuaded that it would make sense to have flexibility on these two points, one being that there's some difference in the nature of the bus stop, and where you have something, obviously you've already made an investment, but that may occur in other places where they haven't done it yet, which may be a similar condition. And while I think that, Mr. Linton spoke about the benefit of common elements, which is most of what we have here in these guidelines. I mean, most of what's here, which we're not talking about, is really important stuff that makes them more recognizable, that makes it easier for customers to understand what it is available at that place. But that doesn't mean it has to be exactly the same at each place. And I agree there are a lot of places in which a pole is not appropriate. I also agree that there are places where that sign doesn't need to be quite as big. Having a slightly smaller sign would be appropriate when there's only one bus route there in particular, as Mr. Downey was pointing out. Those seems to me to be minor accommodations to what would otherwise be a fairly uniform system if adopted. So what I would suggest is, our motion at this point is still the resolution. Mr. Giancola hadn't actually yet moved his amendment. And what I'm going to suggest is that we pass it. We're not acting on it today. It's going to committee. So this is the second thing that Mr. Graham said that I agree with. This needs to be right when we approve it at the board.
Yeah.
So I suggest that the committee send the resolution forward along with direction that language be drafted. And between now and then, council and everybody else can figure out where it needs to be exactly to provide that, whether it's in the document itself as an amendment or in the the resolved clause or somewhere else, but that specifically asks for these two precise areas of flexibility to be incorporated without respect to jurisdiction, and that such language be ready for distribution prior to the board meeting so everyone can see it before the board meeting and we can make final approval. If those are the only issues on the table and we're otherwise ready, then I think that would be complete action by the committee. Mr. Benjamin.
I do have an amendment I would wish to offer.
Additional matter? Okay.
On the two resolves, first two resolves,
mm-hmm.
That prior to the
close, we disclosed that this was during calling.
Well, he was asking whether there was more before we figured out how we were going to dispose of it.
Right, because you might want to add to the direction portion of this, or it may be simple enough that you have something we actually want to do an amendment here now. But
so my suggestion, which I'm not moving at this point, so we can make it part of that same discussion, is that on the two resolves that are on page two, the top two there.
Yep.
Before the semicolon, put in both places, to be implemented as funds become available and opportunities present themselves, which I think is the discussion that we just had.
Sure.
Well.
Let me ask on the two previous things. Mr. Giancola, how do you feel about that as a way to proceed?
Oh, I like that idea.
Okay. So, Then is there agreement that the motion to pass the resolution forward would be amended to provide additional direction to staff to provide language for final approval at the board to accomplish those two kinds of flexibility that were discussed here.
I will move that.
All right. If there's no objection, we'll incorporate that in the motion. Hearing no objection. Now, let me ask staff before I go back. Does staff understand what we just said?
Yes.
Okay. And back to...
My stuff?
We'll get there in a second. But Mr. Graham, are you still on this?
Let's see the specific language, because I'm not sure flexibility is the issue.
Well, I agree that we have to see the language.
Because I think in the case where there's an actual design structure which accommodates this and was intended to accommodate this, we don't want...
Mr. Hamry, can you have something out next week, say Monday?
We want a direction.
We certainly can.
Because then the staffs can look at it, and the jurisdictional staff can see it, and they can say, yes, this is doing what we need, or no, it's not, here's other language. And we would be able to have something before the board prior to its meeting, so at the board, you know, they have the opportunity to vote on exactly what.
But each shelter location isn't uniformly consistent either, and that's why the flexibility aspect is easier for us to manage than, you know, a specific directive that every situation like that has to be handled directly.
Okay. Mr. Benjamin?
And with the change that I made, you nodded yes.
Could you read it one more time?
To put before the semicolon to be implemented.
Which semicolon are we talking about? Wait, I'm sorry, which one are you in now?
On the two resolves, identical language.
You want to say this twice? Oh, I see.
Yes, because they are different resolves for different parts of the guidelines. And before the semicolon, which then has and be it further, at the end of the real substance of the resolve, to be implemented as funds become available and opportunities present themselves.
Well, you know, I would say I certainly wouldn't. If that's incorporated in it, I'm still going to vote for the thing. You know, I will say I'd hate to see us so watering something down, which in fact should be pushing us forward over time. We have 12,000 bus stops in this region. Most of them are inadequate. They're inadequate both for the condition that exists, that people have to wait for buses at or leave from buses. They're inadequate in providing information to make it possible for somebody who wants to take a bus to figure out where they're going. This is a fairly significant, I think, regional effort to bring some uniformity to that and to push forward the standard. If you approve this, this is something people will come forward and say, you know, you're not meeting standards at all these bus stops. You're right to anticipate that. Mm-hmm. I hope they do that, because we should not just wait and say, whenever dollars show up, we're going to improve a stop. We, in fact, should have a plan for improving our bus stops. And I hope we will get there. This does not do that, so it does not outright commit anybody to a dollar of anything. But yes, it will create some impetus for doing something about the 12,000 bus stops around our region. And that presents the possibility for a long-term plan that, in fact, should be incorporated into our capital planning. That would be one of my hopes for it. So, you know, let me be explicit about that.
May I comment about that?
Please.
And I agree with you completely, and I echo your comment from earlier. And that provides the opportunity for us, in the context of the Finance Committee and the adoption of budgets, to do exactly that. And there's nothing here that says we can't make those funds available. I just don't want somebody to come back and say, you know, you're not following your own guidelines. What I want to do is leave it so that those pressures, if they come upon the board and the board decides that they want to put that money into the budget, and they do want to do the implementation, which I think will cost substantially more than Mr. Hamry's recommendation or estimate, that we will in fact do that and do that in the appropriate context, exactly as you suggested.
Could we have, I'm trying to think of wording, if we could have the language refer to, you know, availability of funds and something about capital planning, you know, future capital planning for the bus system or something that references the fact that it's subject to our actually having a budget for it that we don't necessarily have identified.
How about to be considered in future capital planning and to be implemented?
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay.
If you write that one out. I like that one. He's writing it down now. So. And while he's doing that, are there any additional comments or questions or further discussion?
No, we can just keep writing resolutions and laws as we're at it. So.
Well, we seem to be moving on pretty good here. So we have, do you want to read it out again?
Mm-hmm. Amend the two resolves to add before the semicolon, to be considered in future capital planning and to be implemented as funds become available and opportunities present themselves.
Is there objection to including that in the motion?
discussion?
Well, you know, I don't think I particularly need the protections. I think it's inherent in what we do that everything is subject to budget. That's my response. And like you, Mr. Chairman, I think we need a little pressure on this issue, quite frankly. And I from having been on the other side of these tables, I think it's, you know, that kind of tension to drive us in the direction that we need to be going anyway is healthy. So I don't think I need protection from it, to be real candid. So I would leave it as it is.
Mr. Giancola, do you have an opinion on this one?
I support the changes we're talking about.
Do you support Mr. Benjamin's recommendation?
Yes.
Well, that's 2-2. Well, we need to move this forward to the board, and I think I'll accede to the request of the chairman, although my view is that expressed by Mr. Linton. But in the interest of moving this forward and raising its prospects for approval at the board, I'll support the request. Do you want to vote on that? If not, I'll just ask if there's no objection, we'll incorporate it in the motion.
Why don't you do it then?
You're not objecting?
There's no objection.
No objection, okay. With the comments made, there is no objection, and the motion is amended to incorporate Mr. Benjamin's additional language on the two resolved clauses. And with that, the question is on the final action of the resolution as amended and with additional direction as given. If there's no further discussion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. That will be forwarded on to the board for the next board meeting in 2 weeks, I believe
it
is.
Thank you very much.
But we'll see the additional language next week so that they can be reviewed. All right, moving along. We have safety and security. Mr. Kubitschek.
Actually, this segment is going to be done by Chief Cable and Chief.
Chief, good to see you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, other members of this committee, as well as other members of the board. I would like to briefly take you through the safety report today and then turn it over to Acting Chief Jerry Lee, who will cover the security portion. Before we begin today, I would like to give the board an update on the activities of the selection panel for the Chief Safety Officer position. We have concluded, we have recommendations that will be provided to the General Manager and this board later today, and we'll seek his approval and your concurrence for that particular person.
To name a new Chief Safety Officer?
Yes, sir.
You said our concurrence. I don't believe actually the board has any role in that, but we obviously are very interested.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, as mentioned previously, I will continue to update the committee on safety actions taken on, you know, that we've already taken, as well as those that we are working diligently on. I would like to highlight a few items, beginning with the one that is not on this list, and it involves the document that was presented to you, and that's the audit of the Tri-State Oversight and the Washington Metropolitan Transit Authority that I provided to you, as well as the oral testimony that was provided by Administrator Rogoff and delivered to the National Capital Region delegates last Thursday, March 4th. And briefly stating that this audit, previously scheduled for mid-2010, was accelerated at the request of Secretary of Department of Transportation, Mr. LaHood, as well as Senator Barbara Mikulski of Maryland. And this audit sort of departed from its normal process, and it focused on two things. In the aftermath of the Fort Totten accident, and in light of the well-publicized difficulties with the Tri-State Oversight Committee, that what they encountered with respect to the WMATA right-of-way access. However, we are extremely grateful for the Federal Transit Administration for expanding the scope of this audit at our request to also include a review of our technical capacity to implement our safety program. We thank them for bringing their expertise to bear on this issue. Now, quickly, and speaking directly for the WMATA, the FTA audit focused on the level of quality of coordination between the Tri-State Oversight Committee and WMATA to ensure safety for WMATA's passengers and employees, and to also follow up on open, non-compliant corrective actions. With regard to deficiencies and challenges, throughout the course of this audit, FTA identified several deficiencies regarding the implementation of 49 CFR 659, as well as ongoing challenges in maintaining the quality of oversight relationship. To address these concerns, FTA issued 21 recommended findings. 11 of those findings were directed to the Tri-State Oversight Committee, and 10 of those recommendations were directed to WMATA. FTA issued specific findings and recommendations to TARC and WMATA to address the identified deficiencies and challenges, and issued these findings, and we are required both TARC and WMATA to comply with these findings within 60 days, and that would be by May 4, 2010. For WMATA, due to FTA's lack of direct regulatory authority of rail transit agencies, including WMATA's, FTA issued recommendations where FTA believes improvements are needed. Though WMATA is under no legal obligations to address these recommendations, they, FTA, believes that these recommendations support more effectively implementation of the safety program elements. Further, they, FTA, stand ready to provide technical assistance and on-site support to WMATA to address the recommendations in this report. And we again applaud the FTA for offering this technical assistance.
Okay. Chief, so when you say this report, you mean this one?
Yes, sir.
Which is dated March 4th?
Yes, sir.
Okay. In your summary here, you talk about a number of different interaction between FTA and this agency leading up to this, where they issued questions and you gave responses and so on. But in the end, this has a set of recommendations.
Absolutely.
And you've just said that there's a May completion date?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, leaving aside the ambiguity that may be raised by whether or not they have the authority to make you do that or not, we do, and obviously we will. So what I want to know is, in what form are we going to see tabulated, here's the things that they said are deficiencies, here's what we're doing, here's the check that we did that.
We will do it in the same manner in which we responded to the Road Worker Protection Program, where they offered up 18 findings, and we sort of developed a corrective action program plan that identified the findings, identified what actions WMATA would take, the timelines in which we would provide that, and who would be the responsible party to make sure that that is carried out. And we will do the same thing in response to this particular audit.
Okay, so when we look at the back of this, and
yes,
we have audit finding, and then we have action required, and we're going to basically see,
yes, sir,
columns after this that says, absolutely, here's when we're doing it, here's that we did it.
Absolutely.
And how soon will the board receive that?
We expect not to take up the 60 days, and hopefully we can have that done within 3 weeks, because many of those items that have been identified, we've already started to work on those. And we continue to work on that. So
I'm sorry, what is, so the 60 days refers to a deadline for what?
For the corrective actions addressing these recommendations that came
to
out
be
of
taken.
Report. Right.
Right. So I'm just talking about getting the table basically that says, here's all the stuff they told us, here's the status of those items.
I would say within 3 to 4 weeks we will have that table provided with the timelines in which we can accomplish the things that have been identified.
Okay. Can we say that definitely in advance of the next meeting of this committee that we'll see that?
Sure. I'm confident that we will have that prepared for you.
Okay. I look forward to it. Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment on that, Chief. I would want to go one step farther. I mean, these are one of the audits and reports. There's lots of other safety reports that are out there, some from our Inspector General, some from our own internal evaluations of our operations. You know, I just don't want it to be limited to just the TOC report, and certainly expand it to include the NTSB issues. So some centralized report or effort, probably in the safety office, to kind of keep an eye on all these things, recognizing that some of them have different kinds of recommendations.
Absolutely.
And some have different kinds of reporting we may do with it. But we need to have some centralized, coordinated effort for all the safety discrepancies.
And yes, we do, sir. regarding the corrective action matrix, we've already identified all of the recommendations that have come, whether they were by a triennial review, an APTA peer review, an NTSB investigations, and they all are contained in this matrix. Right now, when you go back to 2006, where there were over 200, we now have reduced that down to 63. That includes the NTSB recommendations. It does not include the NTSB recommendations relative to the June 22nd crash, or the West Falls Church, or this recent audit of the TOC, but it will be populated in that right. same database.
Yeah, some in fact may be recognized by several different reports.
Absolutely.
Same item.
Absolutely.
Ms. Litt.
Mr. Giacola, I think you also speak to the problem that we have, which is that we have multiple jurisdictions, multiple agencies designing and making recommendations for safety. And unlike FRA and others, you know, where you have one party that's responsible, compliant to one, we have multiple. And some may, in fact, have different views on the same issue.
Right.
And I would suspect that they would. Without FTA having statutory authority to impose this, and the TOC being in the situation that it's in, and then you have the NTSB, which has no responsibilities to anybody, because they can just ask for whatever they think the world should provide. And our staff is then responding in that regard to three or four different requests, and maybe different what they need to do to respond to each. So that's, I think you're getting a sense of the challenges and the requirements that are going to need to be addressed by the Congress on this whole safety issue, not just for Metro, but for the country.
I think that's a good point, and you know, as was noted by the chief, but also as was noted at the outset of the testimony that Administrator Rogoff gave, you know, this is outside the scope of what FTA is currently authorized to do. So they've given in this instance a more intensive look because they were asked to do so, and that includes being asked by us.
Yes.
So I mean this. Intense scrutiny that we've gotten here and which we look forward to acting on is here in large part because WMATA said, come help us do this. The legislation that, of course, is prospective may change the situation nationally, and perhaps this will be more routinely the role FDA will take, but that is yet to be determined. Did it follow up?
And Mr. Chairman, I actually think, you know, I think this should be the guiding light or the guiding measurement that we move forward in terms of responding. And I'm just trying to move us towards some consistency in our approach so that our staff has some direction in terms of, you know, which direction you're, who you're answering to by the behavior and the direction that you're taking. And I think this seems to be both our request, it seems to be responding to the Congress, it seems to be direction in which the FTA is hopefully going to be able to go once they get the authority. And hopefully we can get this into a singular response that we can all focus on and our staff can focus in their attention and their interest in solving our safety issues.
Instead of having N different agencies at any time looking over various things and providing advice that may or may not even be consistent with one another,
exactly.
Have one federal authority channel that.
That's right.
And focus everybody. I very much agree with that. Mr. Benjamin.
And I would associate myself with those remarks also, and note the fact that when four agencies all review the same thing and even come up with the same conclusion, it looks like the same thing happened four times than it didn't. It happened once. But a lot of our discussion here was procedural, and I was just wondering, I thought I heard in the discussion that it appeared that we had no significant and substantive disagreements with the FTA? Findings?
Absolutely none. I think that it's in our best interest to address safety, whether it's coming from FTA, NTSB, internally, we have to take care of these things that have been identified, and they've been identified for a while.
So what we're saying is, we hear what the FTA says, we don't disagree with what the FTA says, and we are putting together now, and you will be presenting to the board and others exactly what we will be doing to rectify those situations.
Absolutely, sir.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Graham and Mr. Brown.
Thank you very much. I've just reviewed this quickly.
And a lot of these requirements, well, number one, a lot of the requirements at the TOC really involve us. Even though it says TOC, it's very much a combined assignment, and we need to recognize that. But much of all of these recommendations, and I haven't had time to review it as carefully as you have, involve planning and notice and acknowledgement and, you know, that type of thing. But I want to ask the question about the sum and substance of all of this. And if we could have your statement or the general manager's or somebody's statement on just what all of this really boils down to, and then what is some sense of what the cost will be. We've been given uniformly a date of May 4th. Some of these things, I suspect, have a very minimal cost, but maybe because of your analysis and review, you've identified things with the more significant cost. So, number one, tell me what the sum and substance of this is, and number two, what is the price tag associated with it?
Okay, the sum and substance is that all transit agencies, especially those that have some aspects of rail, have to adhere to 659. That's the federal regulations now. That speaks to implementation of a system safety program plan that is very prescriptive, and it sort of identifies all of these things that are contained in the recommendations that speaks to a systems approach to safety, a coordination effort, hazard identification, how we communicate, how we look at data to come up with trends, and how we stop an accident before it happens. So it combines a variety of that, who the chief safety officer reports to, how information is shared, how information is brought forth. A lot of it entails training, certification, recertification, making sure that you don't have an employee who's out on the right of way for 15 years, never having had a recertification training, and with the expectation that he or she will carry out those functions, is making sure that we have data systems that, as we individually put information into the data system that talks about maintenance, that talks about repairs, that talks about doors that open indiscriminately, that we can all look at this data and come up with something is wrong with that picture, and we need to look at the trends, and we need to bring it to light before something bad happens. That's one part of it, and it entails a variety of different things that most transit agencies, whether you're bus or rail, need to have in place. We can't no longer depend on people. We have to depend on systems to make sure that we are safe, and that is the approach that the FTA is taking. That's the approach that the NTSB takes, and that should be the approach that all transit agencies take.
And how much?
And the cost, relative, we've reached out to the National Transit Institute as well as the Transportation Safety Institute to bring in training that will provide that information that helps us identify hazardous information. How do we track? How do we do investigations? That's a piece that we need to provide not only to our frontline employees, but we also need to provide that to our supervisors. That's a price tag that without going and guessing, I would not want to guess, and I think Mr. Cato is...
But there are, if I may, Mr. Chairman, there are very specific recommendations which we welcome, and we embrace and we want to comply with. But each of these actions has some cost associated with it. So I want to get a better idea of just what that is.
Thank you for raising that. In addition to what I asked for... Yeah. Estimate on the cost of those should be included, and understanding that on some of those you'll have a good number, and then some of them you'll be able to say, well, we don't know yet, but we think it's in the range of. Give us the best you got.
Okay.
But Mr. Chairman, that has to happen with some speed.
Yes, it does.
Because they want, and we want to comply, we want to meet the deadline of May 4th.
The deadline of May 4th is to respond back to them with our plan. That plan, as in the case of the 1,000 vehicle replacement, may go 3-4 years down the road, but we have to provide them the timelines in which we're going to get things accomplished.
I think we're asking for this information within 3 weeks, Mr. Graham, because the meeting's in 4 weeks, and they've got to distribute to us before then. Right. So if you have it sooner than then, we'd like it sooner.
But yes. Absolutely.
Mr. Downey, we...
Yeah, on the issue of the multiplicity of recommendations that are out there, I think it is important we continue to track on all of those.
Yes.
And report on all of those. And quite honestly, some of them, the tracking will be, we don't agree, or we're not going to do it.
Sure.
or there's a good reason to not do it, or two agencies have said different things, but we can't leave it hanging out there that we've shoved some under the desk and are dealing with others. We really need to be able to comprehensively say, how are we responding?
Very well said. Anything further? All right, I'm not going to ask you, Chief, to go through the rest of this, which is the monthly complication, and we've all had a chance to read it. If there are no further questions on it, I'm going to try and move us to our last item in view of the time. So thank you very much. We look forward to hearing more from you on those other items. The last item is a report that we requested on manual versus automatic operation and operational restrictions and what impact they may have on the current conditions on the rail system. And Mr. Kubitschek, you do have at least some initial findings for us.
Yes, sir. Yeah, we've got some initial information that we can provide. You know, at this time, at the direction of our last committee meeting, was to basically start this endeavor, to kind of give some type of summarization on what we're facing right now in comparison to what we saw a decade ago whenever there were some other restrictions that were in put before us. Okay. So we used the June 22nd, 2009 kind of as our baseline. And then the last time that we actually faced an incident where we had to go into a manual mode was back in March of 1999. So I don't have a better phrase for legacy or heritage, but we did have to go back and heard some information that wasn't readily available, but we were able to corral some information.
I mean, even from 99 to 2000, it was hard to get.
Yes, sir. Readily available. It gets really down, and if I could talk a little bit about going rest to the safety component and getting back to these recommendations. One of the things that we have here is, say, for instance, you have electronic database, which is for maintenance records, which is Maximo. Great product. We're evolving and moving in that direction. You've got general ledger information like a PeopleSoft system. Well, then you start getting into other reports that are generated by a bus department or a quality department or safety department. One of the things that the agency is really challenged on is a mechanism in which we input this information electronically, and it basically is sustained in one global environment. So that way we can trend our information and analytics work it. And that's why the chief and I have had a lot of dialogue, and I fully support him on that. It's really about a system, not individuals. So that way it's sustained. And it's a business model as we move forward on that. So, Mr. Graham, and to the rest of the committee as well, there is going to be some costs associated with that. That's what we're working on. But there's just multiple avenues that we've got to spend some more time picking and removing information. The other component that we've also spoken with the FTA and what we try to plan now is that while everything is focused on the rail operations, and someday, some component, bus operations could also come underneath that type of scrutiny. So you also want to make sure you're developing those systems, that you have a little bit of latitude so that way, you don't interrupt everything that you've established in the future date. So I'll move back into the general report. Please don't. Okay, back in FY 1999, 2000, we were sitting at about 93.1% average, 6 months prior. Then whenever the event came down where they had to start replacing relays, everything went into manual operation. You saw a degradation of service about 88.4%. If you notice and you look at what we went through on our system here, didn't put in the additional information prior to, but whenever we got in here about 2007, we had some of our alignments that were in the 87-88%, and slowly but surely we started progressing up. Up to that point in time of the June 22nd incident, on all the alignments, we were averaging about 93.5. And as you can see, whenever the average 6 months, post then, we're sitting at about 88.8%. Both of them are about, pretty much exactly about 5% on average, rule of thumb. Some of these things are, again, operators need additional time to manually stop at the stations. One of the things, for example, is like pulling into a station. Our regulated speed in ATO is approximately 35 to 38 miles an hour upon entry of the station when the system is operating. And then it basically goes into a braking mode. When an operator hasn't been doing that for a long time and they're relying on a system, it takes a while for them because they're directly controlling the rail car consist, and that impacts your schedule. So that's just a fact of the system.
Let me pause just 1 second. Before we went to full manual, wasn't the regular operation of the system, didn't we include a portion of time for every operator to run manually during their week of?
We did during, say, for instance, during the course of the day. But again, you're dealing with an off-peak period versus a peak environment. And the peak environment is really critical. Whenever you're in an off-peak period and you have a wider headway of 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, you're easily to absorb it. But whenever you get into the peak period, you know, and you're talking 3 minutes,
So before June 22nd, they were running manual. They were getting a chance to practice manual on a routine basis. But you're doing it at off-peak times.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden they got to do it at the biggest loads when the closest train spacing and so on.
Pretty much maximum capacity, maximum deployment.
Okay.
The other thing is again, the controllers, whenever we go into more of a manual type mode, you definitely have to increase your review of the overall space because, you know, some operators are very comfortable and operate very robustly. Others are very hesitant, you know, very nervous, and, you know, that dictates into the quality of the ride that we all witness. Next slide, please. Okay, what we did here is we tried to depict. You have to forgive us that we weren't able to get exactly, you know, the same type of, you know, time frame and months and everything else, but we kind of looked at, you know, 6 months, you know, prior to and 6 months, you know, after. And the only thing that I would really like to note is, say, for instance, like here in our manual operation in December, one of the things that we saw a degradation of service was, again, because of the huge snow event that took place. You know, what we're looking at is actual, the way that the railroad is operating and such, but you know, pretty much consistently, whenever you look at it over historical profile, we're kind of following the, you know, the same type of trend on what's taking place.
Well, where was the snow in
December?
Well, we didn't reach that yet. This date only goes up to last December. So.
Yeah, to December. Yeah, so if you can notice, like this top line and got it here, we did 6 months before, 6 months after, and this is just a straight comparison. So there are some other, you know, factors, fall and everything else that come into play of your operating environment.
I mean, the things, there are two striking things about this. One, that it tracks almost identically the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you see this huge drop initially, which is consistent with your, you know, your story that, well, first doing it takes a while for operators to adjust, so the performance really falls at first, and then it recovers.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what happens if you play those lines out for more months. I don't know what happened in 2000, but we'll have some more months of data for this time, for sure. But it really does track very closely. It also says that even, you know, once you stabilize, you've got about a 5% difference in performance between operating in automatic and manual.
Yeah, and we've actually seen some improvement, you know, on what's taking place. And if I could, further in our presentation, we also have some challenges that weren't present in 1999 or 2000 that we're currently addressing right now, and that's due to the integrity of the system and everything else. And those are also some critical players that are also impacting, I can say, our real-time day-to-day environment versus the status of the system back in 1999 or 2000. Next slide, please. Okay, just some information. 35% more ridership from 1999, 2000 timeframe to now. We're actually deploying, you know, 50% more rail cars actively in the system than during that timeframe in a decade. You know, that's twice as many potential failures, twice as many, you know, incidents that are out there. It's just a staggering effect of what the challenges as the system continues to mature, what they're against. The other thing is like train constant patterns. You know, in the 1999-2000 timeframe, you're only operating 4 cars and 6-car trains. You know, now you're operating 6 and 8. Your capacity's getting longer. Your train consists are getting more complicated on what's taking place. There's a lot of variables that are tied into that. The other item that we put in there, restrictions put in place by Metro, that'll be touched on the next slide. And those are kind of self-inflicted. But this, as you look at FY09, I was debating to put this also back into the 1999-2000. Because, for example, absolute blocks, while you still had a tendency right now, based on the June 22nd incident, based on the use of our loss of shunt tool, based on our ever-increasing standards on the way that we're reviewing and scrutinizing our, you know, our train control system in regards to safety, this is something that is a day-to-day practice that wasn't ever really followed as rigid or robust as nature. It has an impact on service, but again, it's something that we're doing for system reliability and also for the safety, you know, of the system as a whole. Placement of the 1000 series in the middle of trains. a huge obstacle, you know, right there. I mean, that wasn't even brokered, but it's a huge impact, a huge drain on resources.
But you don't have that quantified. I mean, I know you've said that, and it's, I can understand, I think, some of why that might be the case, but that still is not quantified.
There is a little segment down there at the bottom, and like I said, as I get, start getting more information going back and forth, I'll be coming back with additional information.
You mean that last item about the 17%?
Yes, yes. Because, for example, you know, whenever we look at uniform consists, and uniform consists are basically running more light fleet without the mixture and stuff, you're looking at, you know, 17%. That's a pretty substantial number. I needed a little bit different way to quantify that to get everybody's attention. But 17% in our scale is a huge impact on service. And then the other component, if I could stress as well, is that on my part, as we look at this, you know, it's one thing to deal with the crashworthiness of the 1000 series cars and all the issues that are associated with it. But when you look in the degradation of service and you start having service interruptions and the placement of those service interruptions, when you have them in the tunnel or you have them in an aerial structure, that's the further analysis that we're looking at from a cost-benefit analysis, say, what is truly the safest way for us to operate this system? Because in some ways, whenever you're stranding trains or backing trains up in aerial structures or putting tens of thousands of people underground, you know, in an area where we're having to recover, there's an offset, you know, to that that really needs to be factored in. Not making any excuses. It's just the fact of what we're working through, and we'll continue to look at this. The other component, again, is like speed restrictions. You know, speed restrictions are always, you know, put in place. That could be for track conditions. That could be also due to weather conditions, you know, for a variety of things. All trains stopping at the end of the platform, you know, that's something that we impose. That's something that we're, for example, I'm surveying some other properties to see their kind of their protocol and what they're doing with their systems, you know, now. I didn't have all the necessary information. But for us, you know, why did we do that? Well, one, we knew that we were, when you have a 50% more deployment of equipment, we have offside door openings taking place.
Well, we know the reasons we did it, okay. but you're continuing to evaluate
specifically
what the impact may be.
Absolutely. I mean,
this is identifying it, but
yes, sir.
You're going to come back to us with
further
analysis.
This is not a stop. This is basically a general summary of, you know, our life or snapshot of what's taking place here.
Okay. What about other impacts on performance from problems on the tracks, such as folks may have read about today in a newspaper article?
I didn't read the paper, sir, so.
Story quotes your folks, but the question is whether there are other kinds of track problems of various sorts, of things, you know, defects and things not working.
Oh, like this morning, for example, whenever we had the speed restriction at Wheaton this morning, where we, you know, this is part of our preventative maintenance program. 2000, I know that this system was not going through doing ultrasound tests and lateral load testing like you're doing right now. You know, this morning, 3:30 or about 3 a.m., I got a call. They detected two cracks, you know, two major potential incidents. Beforehand, that would have maybe been viewed as a speed restriction. My criteria and the duty cycle equipment they were using, I can't chance that. And we won't chance that. And so we shut down the alignment. We had delayed opening. We had to do some single tracking. You know, we're going to take the hit of that. But what we're
you're saying in the middle of the night somebody detected something and you said, well, we have to work around this basically because it's potentially a dangerous situation.
Absolutely.
And that then affects performance.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, you know, the question is to what degree, if you, you know, the cumulative effect of those kinds of things, you know, what degree is that impacting it? And what does that tell us about, I mean, you're having more of those problems than you used to have. That's probably related to our maintenance, our investment in the...
For example, going back into historical information to look at how many times, say, for instance, the system on where you had speed restrictions placed at, and then also why they're being placed. You know, I can tell you that our numbers are probably, I think on average, we're probably up anywhere from 50 to 70% now compared to a couple of years ago. There's several factors into that. Again, loss of shunt testing, the way that we're maintaining the system, the status of the track conditions that we're out there seeing, the utilization, you know, of other technology that's out there. And then the other component, again, is that as a system, as I brought in samples here, you know, brought those samples in with all sincerity so that y'all got an idea of the conditions of the track, the conditions of, you know, the fasteners and everything else of what we're facing, you know, on that. And, you know, those are not brought in here with a lighthearted, you know, expectations on my part is to fully communicate and to disclose to the board on what we're facing, you know, at this point in time.
I understand. So the issue, though, for us, because it really does come to particularly our capital budgeting and, mm-hmm. and where we're spending the money and whether we're devoting the resources in the right place. So, you know, at some point we need that translated into, you know, we have these eight different problem areas, and if you take one of them, it's the result of something else. And if you want to fix it, you'd have to do more of this over here.
Yeah.
And what would be the return in terms of improvement to the dollar spent there as opposed to something else? So we have to get these then turned into, you know, something that relates to the whole capital program so we can see, you know, if what you're trying to do is get back to an acceptable level of operational performance, what are the types of things that we need to do and what mixture and on what time frame can you do them?
Well, if I could share with y'all also, if y'all are aware, I've come forward with y'all like with a 10-year program for rail cars and rolling stock, which we'll be talking about later on the month 7K. I'm doing exactly the same thing in my track and structure and system side as well. It's just that you cannot populate these things, you know, overnight. And I've had a lot of different, and this is no excuses, it's just a fact. I've had a brand new staff or a different set of staff that we're approaching the maintenance and philosophy in which we're undertaking, you know, these efforts. And we're very, very close to having like a kind of like a 10-year look ahead from our perspective on what it's really going to take to really address this system. You know, for example, in my opinion, you look at it where they say in the previous plans that were put out here several years ago, you know, 10 miles done, you know, on an annual basis. My estimation right now, we should be doing 20 to 40, you know, but I'll come back and I'll quantify that. And again, there's other factors of what's driving that, because I think that as everybody looks at this system, you know, it's easy whenever it's new, but you start getting those operations folks in the way of it, you makes it a lot more difficult to maintain the system. And then I think the other thing was that the growth of this system and not being able to capture it, you know, and offset it to see the streamline of what's taking place. But again, it has to be quantified to y'all. And that's what I'll be coming back with, is a plan to say, TSSM, this perspective, they're staying this, and again, it gets back into like a maintenance philosophy. You have an area where you have a switch that, say, for instance, 30 years old. It moves five times a month. I'm not saying that it's a bad switch. It's old. But if I have a 20-year-old switch that moves 5,000 times a month, you know, versus one that moves five, my prioritization is a little bit different. And that's also part of the reason why we've come back to y'all to talk about these major outages, where you've seen major outages like Arlington. We're going to be working on Roslyn, you know, Lafont. These are critical, vital areas of this infrastructure for this system to continue to maintain properly, like with the guarded number eights and stuff. So, you know, systematically, I'm also been looking in the back to start showing you where we've hit these areas, because it has improved our reliability, because I guarantee if we hadn't been permitted to do these things, we would have other incidents. And I'm not going to say that we're going to be innocent. There are a lot of things out there that are a big concern on my part, and we're moving as fast as humanly we can.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Benjamin, and
Especially if I look at the end of this, the last page of your presentation.
Which is a summary page.
What I see here is, this is the price we pay for doing manual operations. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes, sir. This is what we're facing with at this time.
And the other side of the equation is, we're doing it because we want to be safe.
Absolutely.
And we believe that manual operation is necessary for safety.
That is correct.
Are there any things that are safer in automatic operation relative to manual?
Sure, you can draw comparisons that there might be certain variables or certain operational characteristics that would be, you know, more efficient in the ATO mode.
Not efficient, safe.
Safe.
Are there any ways that you would be more safe in automatic rather than manual? Because this is the downsides of manual, because we want to be safe. Are there some downsides?
I think they're really kind of neutral. I think they're really neutral. We really have to talk about, you know, various situations and conditions. I mean, for example, like where we've had an incident, where we've had a derailment or some incident in the yard, mm-hmm. That is all, you know, manual mode operation. So ATO really has no impact on that.
But let me try an example since we're having trouble with it.
That's the one I tried to.
In automatic operation, is a train likely to go through a red signal?
Thank you.
No.
But in manual operation, it's possible.
It is yes, it is possible, yes.
I guess part of the question that I'm trying to get at and an understanding I'm trying to get to is, to what degree do we take risks manually and to what degree do we take risks with automatic? And what are those balances and how do those trade off against the quality of service that we provide to our people? Clearly, we don't want to compromise safety.
Yeah.
But there are, in fact, risks on both sides, and I don't see that in this analysis.
Yes.
Very good question, and probably as a piggyback to that, since you're going to come back to us with that information anyway. Mm-hmm. Being in the manual versus operating mode, how has this impacted the capacity of the system?
Capacity of the system?
Yeah.
It will have some impact because whenever you're not operating as efficiently, you're going to have some backups, you know, with that. That's just inherent of the process.
And then what about the cost? Has the cost gone up or down as a result of being manual versus automatic?
I would say that there's probably some associated cost because we're wearing out master controllers. You could have a spike in potential workers' comp claim because the operators are having to, utilize the equipment a little bit more. There is some debate going back and forth or discussion about, do you actually use your braking more? It hasn't really been quantified because if you're feathering it, you're going slower versus an absolute where you're running a lot faster and you're braking. It's really a kind of a cost-neutral standpoint on that. But I would say that a manual operation with a jerky operation, whenever you're trying to train line through 8 set of cars and you've probably got, 40 miles of wiring and you're trying to do controls instantaneously, it's creating some, equipment conditions that lead to faults.
Mr. Downey,
just phrasing Mr. Benjamin's question a little differently, or at least exploring it. I don't think we should be looking at the theory of manual versus the theory of automatic. It is manual as we're doing it today, or it is automatic in the way we're able to do it today, in which we do not have confidence that it will perform its function. The great uncertainty of whether the system will work or not in the way it's supposed to, I think, has to weigh pretty heavily in the decision.
I'd just like to see more on both sides of that.
Yeah.
It's still a question, I think, as Mr. Benjamin asked, is, are there risks associated with manual operation? I think the answer is plainly yes.
Yeah.
The net is, of course, the question, and Mr. Kubitschek knows what he thinks the answer to that is, but it's still a question as to what the individual impact, because if we have certain types of risk being introduced by manual,
if I could summarize
think about that.
On this, is that, again, whenever you're dealing with an ATO system that is very complex and that we have a potential known defect and we do not have a layer of other safety mechanisms in place to offset that, for me, the continued operation in manual mode is the priority. I could not sit before this board to say, let's go back to ATO just to gain 2 or 3 or 4% more efficiency on time.
Five, apparently. But
yeah, or five. But the other thing is this.
But
is
no
that,
one is suggesting that, Mr. Kubitschek. The question again is, are we certain that it's actually safer? And it sounds like it probably is, but what you really seem to be telling us is you don't have confidence in the automatic system. And the danger of catastrophic failure there is why we're not operating on it.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean there aren't risks associated with manual.
Yes.
And to compensate for some of those risks, you do other things, like people operate slower, which is part of what's mitigating the risk. Because there is a greater chance of a train going through a red light right now than there is if running under automatic. But that might not be catastrophic because they get intentionally derailed in a hypothetical situation I could think of. Is that not so?
That is correct. But you do have, again, I don't want to get too technical.
No one's questioning your decision on the back end. It's just understanding, what the components are. Mr. Graham?
And then there's this final sentence in the report. Metro is under urgent NTSB recommendation to implement a real-time detection system before returning to automatic. So do you want to say anything more about that?
Well, it's what's been pushed in the NTSB and noted all the documentation. And Is that
so
they,
it's really moot. The question, that's what I'm saying, is as interesting as this discussion is and as valid as the questions are, it's moot. Because we're not going to go to automatic until we have implementation of a real-time detection system.
Yeah, and that still begs also the other statement is that once we quantify the actual fix and repair of us going back to the ATO system to validate that everything is fixed and we have a good understanding of what's taking place, because I still would not want to put us in a position where, yes, I added this other safety mechanism, but you still have a problem with your system. You need to address your system and work in unison with this other technology.
What is the status of this implementation?
Right now, we did this PowerPoint last month. It was a little hurried, but right now we are targeting that we will be real time by the third quarter of calendar year 2010. We're very close. I'm getting ready to go through another evolution in April of the software. So we're getting very close. We've made a lot of good progress. The difficult part for us now will be going into the control center and reprioritizing all the signals and retraining employees and getting the procedures and everything else that's taken place. But I can tell you right now that, for example, on our BlackBerry, there's some of my engineers and maintenance staff that they have the system is actually, through an automated process, is sending them real-time information. And so we're vetting the system.
But so best case is this fall is what you just
summer,
said.
Okay. Summer.
Winter.
Well, you said third quarter.
I'm sorry,
you
third
said
quarter.
Third quarter 2010.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I should say fourth quarter. I'd say winter to make sure
third
I got time.
Is different than ever.
Yes, sir. I know.
I mean, next year?
I made
or?
A mistake. I apologize.
I realize you can't. Hang on a second. I realize you can't say. I realize you can't necessarily say with certainty, but
I would say fourth quarter 2010 in the winter months. That is my target.
Fall. Give us a month.
Yeah, well, I mean,
no.
What?
Don't give us a month.
Don't give us a month.
All right, I'll say December.
Okay, hang on here. So that, I mean, this is great fun, but it would be nice if we had some kind of clear idea. Do you think this is something that can happen this calendar year?
The loss of shunt automated tool. Yes, sir.
And the return to automated operation.
The other component of this is that we are actively testing a repair to our ATO system, and once we get that evaluated.
Do you think it is possible that we could return to automatic operation during calendar year 2010?
There is a possibility.
But you're not confident we'll be able to do that?
Not at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I had Ms. Shula, I believe. Nope. And Mr. Litton.
I think his not at this time, he's confident that we can meet that date was what I thought the answer would be.
Should be.
I didn't want it to reflect any certainty because there's still a great deal of uncertainty in this. And so I'm not looking for a newspaper article tomorrow saying we're returning to automatic train control by December. No, we're not. So all the pens that are writing, get your erasers.
And you have to understand, the implication of that is the system will continue to perform at a subpar level throughout this year. And absent anything else that improves it, no one should expect it's going to get a whole lot better. Because that's just where we're at. Not the answer any of us want, but that appears to be the best available information right now. Any other questions? In that case, we will conclude. Thank you all very much. Please adjourn.